Washington, September 19, 1979. This is side one, the first of two tapes, a discussion between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, labor analyst, University of Minnesota, their labor education service, and myself concerning the 1934 Minneapolis General Driver Strike. This is in Seattle, Washington, September 19th, 1979. This is side one, the second of two tapes, a discussion between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, labor research analyst, University of Minnesota. Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the 1934 Minneapolis General Drivers Strike.
Was this another way to further
Hello.
Undermine? Governor Olson requesting to see a rank-and-file committee was, in your opinion, then just another way to undermine the union's position by circumventing the union's negotiators and leaders?
Well,
he thought he would have a better chance of getting concessions out of a rank-and-file committee.
I'm sure that was the intent.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, why would he have had an order? It's hard for me to believe that the adjutant general would embark upon such a move on his own volition.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be couched. And I'm convinced that, I get a drink of water here. I missed you before. I'm convinced that Olson had thought it all out. Now remember, he was under pressure from the employers to do something. Somebody had to take them off the hook for not agreeing to the Hawes-Dunnigan. So I believe that Olson felt that if he could, now I'm speculating, if he could jail the leaders, then there would be no problem to sell some kind of a bastard agreement to a rank and file committee. Now, Olson had completely underestimated the educational procedure that had been developed in, you might say, 3 or 4 months by Skogie and Ray and Farrell and Brown, Mickey Dunn, Grant, to the ranks. And because the union was so democratically operated that most people knew what was going on. But Olson wouldn't accept that if he knew it, because that was not the way that most unions were run. The unions were bureaucratically controlled, and once there, you were there, and you had no right except to pay dues and come to the meeting and get the secret password. But I'm convinced that it was contrived by Governor Olson to get off the hook. And this, in turn, if he could have settled that strike, that would have been a big feather in his hat.
But that was quite a risk for him to take.
What?
What he did in terms of raiding the union, I mean, what he seemed to be doing at that point was saying, okay, I'm going to side with the employers very clearly at this point in time, with the hopes that the rank and file committee will agree to my concessions and the strike will end. That was quite an enormous risk he was taking, don't you think?
No, I don't, because I have to now make a reference and it's aside. The situation, I think he was getting some of his pattern from what was going on in San Francisco, too.
Oh. Uh-huh.
The employers were carrying on a very, very sophisticated fight against the unions there. And by the way, just when we're on it, there was the guy that was the head of the NRA at the time, Hugh Johnson, General Hugh Johnson. He wrote a book called The Blue Eagle from the Cradle to the Grave or something, about that, and it, about that period, and there was quite a bit of information in there. I read it many, many years ago, and it might be helpful for you if you locate it and get some of the thinking, because it may cast a light on which way the that Olson was going. Now, Olson had never been up against a situation that he was confronted with in Minneapolis before. And he was under some hell of a pressure from the employers. They weren't satisfied with anything short of jailing all the strikers and anyone convicted of violence, what they term violence, being deprived of returning the right to work, and they wanted complete control. The Citizens Alliance had the bit in their teeth, and they were putting heat on Olson. It isn't that he was just sitting alone there with the Ouija board at night figuring out new riddles, you know. He was getting pressure from the employers as well as from many people in the Farm Labor Party felt that this would be the end of the Farm Labor Party, too. So Olson was under a lot of pressure. And the biggest guiding light, in my opinion, of Olson was that he was trying to make sure that he was a knight in shining armor in his political stance. That might have been daring, but I don't think it was. I think he just figured best way to get out of this is get some kind of a settlement, get the men back to work, and I'll get the victory for it. And damn the circumstances.
Okay, so you're not saying that he necessarily saw the Citizens Alliance or the employers as the means of support by which he would further his career. He simply felt that the settlement of the strike was the ticket to furthering his career.
Well, yes, but also you have to remember they go hand in hand. If he settled the strike to the satisfaction of the employers, he would then have them in allegiance, not as a mortal enemy. He could have, if he liked, I suppose, at least it's my speculation, that he could have just said, okay, the Hawes-Dunnigan agreement has been accepted by the union. The military will not interfere. There'll be no military permits. Those members that want to operate their trucks can sign up and sign the agreement without any strings to it. He could have said that, but he didn't.
Right.
So he chose all this mumbo-jumbo interpretation, hoping that it would confuse people, and I'm sure without the background of Carl and Ray, especially, but there was Mickey and Grant and Bill and the whole bunch there who were a little bit skookum too, they might have sold it. Because they'd had pretty good luck with that around the country, doing that very same thing. And the thing was going full bore in San Francisco. Same way. Reds were every place, under the beds and in the soup and every place. So I think that motivated him. But he was acting under pressure. He was under pressure from the Citizens Alliance. And as I told you earlier, you know, they didn't just believe that the Farm Labor Party was the answer to the political thinking of their mind.
Now, you made it quite clear that in your meeting with Governor Olson, that you and Ray Rainbow and
Kelly Postal
and whoever else was there spoke to him in no uncertain terms. You didn't
right.
You mince words or soft
tone. That's right.
Tone.
There was
now,
nothing.
There are a variety of possible responses he might have had to your tone. Do you feel that his attitude towards the union changed in any way because of the way you spoke to him? Was he the sort of individual who would be sensitive to that?
Well, basically, he was a practicing attorney before he became governor. He'd been the prosecuting attorney. And he wasn't the kind of a guy to get riffed because somebody said damn in his presence. He was a pretty cool guy, but he was a little hot under the collar because we were hitting him home with, we kept it right on two or three points.
Right.
We signed the agreement that you said was a good agreement, and now you're throwing us in jail because we did it. Why? That's an uncomfortable question for him to answer. He'd made some public commitments in support of the Hart-Dunnigan Agreement. He thought the thing was over.
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is that if he were to have left that meeting angry with you and the union, how would that anger have translated into future action?
Oh, I think he was seething when he left that meeting.
Do you think that affected the way he dealt with you, and if so, how afterwards?
Well, I didn't see any change in his attitude. And I think that he was seething with anger when he left that meeting, and he was, I think, very much upset with us when we were there before Grant and Farrell showed up. But as I say, he's a schooled, practicing attorney. And he'd been not only trained, but he'd experienced over the years, and he was an able attorney. Not to get carried away with emotion, but I know that he was uncomfortable. And I'm sure that he was seething with anger when he left. And he got caught red-handed with his foot in the cookie jar, and he couldn't do nothing else but admit that when he saw the permit that we did have it. And his whole defense was shot right then.
Now, the National Guard supposedly raided the headquarters of the Citizens Alliance as well.
Oh, 3 or 4 days later. And in one of our earlier conversations, I told you that.
Right.
I said, in order to get off the hook, he went down and raided the Citizens Alliance. That was supposed to be the fence mender. I wasn't carried away by that. What?
Was that solely what that action was, or would he have had another purpose in raiding the Citizens Alliance headquarters?
Well, I don't know what the hell he was looking for there. He wasn't looking for bombs or tear gas. And I don't think it was anything else, and I can't speak for Olson, but he was a kind of a devious guy, you know. And a prosecuting attorney, and sometimes, you know, they resort to some sort of bizarre things to accomplish their points. And I don't see why he raided the Citizens Alliance unless he was getting a lot of reaction. Why he raided, you know, the question, a lot of the citizens, now most of the labor leaders that we encountered up in the Sexton building, were very much upset with us. And they were pouting. And I think that their feeling reflected into Governor Olson. And they thought they had this thing under control. Now, many of those guys were around and got their start in the labor movement as a result of the red hunts by Gompers and by Attorney General Mitchell Palmer when they decimated the American labor movement in that period. And they were a little bit hostile to anybody coming in there and rocking the boat. And I'm sure that there was a lot of people in the Farm Labor Party that they were very much disappointed in the role that Olson played, because it's a simple question. The union accepted the agreement, now why jump on them? Now, everyone that wasn't privy to the day-to-day things that I was, and I wasn't in the top everyday negotiations because I was out in the street with a bunch of pickets. But I was around in the strike committee meetings and close enough friends with Farrell and Carl and Ray that I had a little bit of better chance, and I had a little more close relationship with Carl than most people. I was better informed than the most, but the average guy was asking the question. The union accepted. Why did they become the whipping boy? And this, I think, was getting to Governor Olson, and he was steaming about it. Well, the raid on the Citizens Alliance, in my opinion, was, well, I raided them both.
Okay. Do you feel that the AFL leaders who were present in the beginning of that meeting you had with Olson felt threatened by what Local 574 was doing because...
They what?
Felt threatened by Local 574 because its leaders were people they couldn't control? Or why couldn't they lend their support? Why didn't they see things the way you did?
Well, number one, for the most part, they were older men in years.
Mm-hmm.
And they had gone through a period of the union movement being, well, I won't say destroyed, but dealt some very serious blows in the 21-22 period. Many of them had that in their background, and they felt that, the odds are too big and you can't fight and win, so you come along here and you collaborate by getting a loaf or a slice of the loaf. And they didn't have the heart.
Do you think that they also felt very threatened by the possibility that the leadership of 574 and all its members were communists?
Oh, I believe they were imbued with the Red Scare to a degree, but I believe most of them were more concerned about what might happen. Some of them were officials of unions, full-time executive positions. And they had a place of prestige, if they weren't full-time executive officials, where they maneuvered around and they were seen in the right places and they could go to the Nicollet or the Radisson or the Curtis Hotel a couple of times a year and be wined and dined. And maybe there are some of them that were figuring that if this thing catches on, well, it'll start in my union. And many of them owed their very life in the union to their collaboration with the employers, which such as it was. Most of them didn't have any career that I felt was outstanding. They were functionaries, but they were no Eugene Debs, none of them. And they weren't social leaders. But many of them, not all of them, were tied up in the Farm Labor Party. And although the principles of the Farm Labor Party and their understanding of it obviously were at variance, they still believed that, I think many of them, that the Farm Labor Party would be out and the Republicans back in because the Democrats hadn't had much of a track record there in my day around Minneapolis. It was the Republicans or the Farm Labor Party. And, but they certainly didn't have any stomach for a fight, none of them. They can talk all they wanted, but they didn't. And they were trying to get the thing settled. And it was no different than in the 1934 general strike on the West Coast. And we were reading the papers about that. You had Joe Ryan from the ILA and Dave Beck and Mike Casey and McLaughlin from the Teamsters doing the same thing the boss was doing. Everyone's a commie. Tobin was slapping it to us. Beck was out on the West Coast doing the same thing. And their idea of what it was necessary, they were employed, they didn't feel the bite of the Depression, they didn't react to the men that were, had their houses taken away from them, had no visible means of support for their family, had lost practically everything their own and almost all their dignity. They didn't cope with that, they couldn't understand that. And I'm sure that motivated a lot of their thinking.
Do you think that they were getting pressure from the president of the AFL then?
Yes. Oh, no question about it. And,
what could have happened to them had they gone against the president?
Well, the thing that happens to them, like a lot of devout Catholics, they get excommunicated from the church, they'd get removed from office. Hell, that's not unusual. The locals put in receivership, and of course, William Green, the president of the AFL, couldn't have done it. But he surely could have had the international president of the whatever craft they were in declare that the officers of that union had to be removed because they weren't following the policy of the international. And that's no strange thing. That happens every day. It's happening today.
Sure.
But not to the degree it could have happened then. But the right of receivership and appointing controllers and comptrollers for unions was one of the weapons that could have happened, and they could have removed them, just summarily removed them from office. And that had happened to certain people in various parts of the United States where they'd been ostracized and criticized by the officials of their unions.
Well, that makes things clear then.
What?
That makes things clear then as to their reluctance to behave in any different way than they did.
Well, it was against their style. You know, they hadn't been... many of them, you see, Minneapolis was such an open shop city. And the manner in which they lived with the understanding that the employers knew that they just couldn't have absolutely no union. They weren't George W. Pullman, you know. They felt that they, if they didn't have any union, it's better to have one that you can control. And the history in Minneapolis since World War I and the defeat of the unions in 1921 nationally, and Minneapolis as well, took the heart out of a lot of these guys, and they felt, hell, you can't fight. And they did have, most of them were employed. And they'd gone through the Depression with a job. Not out of work, not on the breadline, not bumming a handout from the city. And I suppose that influences them. But they had no taste for any kind of a fight that we were, and we knew, I did at least, that we weren't going to get anything without we fought for it. Damn little we'd get if we fought and won.
So it sounds as though those leaders had just a totally different perspective on what the struggle was.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it in my mind. And I don't mean to say that they weren't probably as firmly entrenched in their belief as I was in mine.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what Kipling said, east is east and west is west.
Mm.
And maybe that was a testing ground for it. He ain't much of a guy to talk about either. He was a scoundrel too. But he was quite a poet along with it all.
Well, I'd like to find out a little bit more about the stockade, but you were never in it, were you?
I give that a wide berth.
Pardon?
I give that a wide berth. I tried to keep out of that.
I bet you did, yeah. We've heard that it was a pretty miserable...
The people over there, it was terrible. It was terrible. There was no conditions much, and it was hastily contrived. It was... operated by the National Guards who had never been called upon. Now, you had remarked earlier in one of our conversations about you'd had a conversation with one of the guardsmen that said they weren't trained for their weapon use or anything else.
Right.
And they had no idea what it was to confine a bunch of prisoners. And that's what they were. And the provost marshal lined them up and give guys 3 years in the stockade like you'd... put a nickel in the parking meter and pay it no mind from there on. And the conditions were intolerable. They had no clothes. There was no facilities for showers. They had some latrines there, I guess, but that's about all. And it was put up out in the fairgrounds out in Tent City, we called it, or Tin City. I forget, we had some satirical comments on it.
Well, apparently, those conditions did not prevail during the whole time that the stockade was being run. We spoke with Mo Hork.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember him?
Oh, I remember Mo real well.
Oh, good. But he said that that when he was in the stockade, those conditions that you just described did in fact exist, but that a committee was formed and he was the spokesperson, and they bit by bit managed to improve the conditions within the stockade such that there was running water finally and places for the men to shower.
Yeah, that's right.
Food.
They did, but when they started out, the conditions were horrible.
That's right.
They were confined. The best way you can describe it was a pig pen. Frank Hall was over there, and they were on the committee. And as I recall, I wasn't there, but Mo was. I think he was there for a while.
Yes.
They had a meeting over there too. You know, after the when they heard that the headquarters had been raided and everything else. And they, I don't know what the hell they done, but they had, they got pretty well organized, you know. You know, the Wobblies had an old expression, there's power in a band of working men. And that's how they cleaned those conditions up.
Yeah.
But they had to be brought to the attention of people, too. They weren't just given into. Least of all, you know, the warden ain't going to listen to the convicts about conditions. So they had to fight for them, and Mo was right. And they probably would have existed the same way that it started out if the guys hadn't beefed about it.
Uh-huh.
But those guys had nothing to lose over there.
Right.
Mm, so they were going to go for broke. More power to them, and I compliment them.
Well, I guess, you know, the thing that's difficult for me to understand is on what grounds exactly were the police, were the people put in the stockade? Ray was put in because he was the leader of the group and he had allowed this rally to take place for which there was allegedly no permit.
Mm-hmm.
Other people were put in for what kinds of violations? Curfew violations, walking around in groups of more than three?
All of it was in that proclamation. And there was a proclamation issued. And whatever it was, they would catch a carload of pickets and ask them what they were doing. And they'd apprehend them if they could catch them. And they caught several. And there was some sort of a law called a rout law, R-O-U-T, that was put into effect up in the days of the Wobbly movements up in the Dakota countries. I think that's the origin of it. And they didn't have to prove you were doing anything, but that you were a member of a union and you were en route to some place that there was going to be violence, and therefore you were presumed guilty. And they followed that principle, that they catch a carload of pickets, what are you doing? I think there was an issue that you were not supposed to be more than three people together at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm?
Yeah, you constituted a riot.
You was three people. Uh-huh. It's all in the proclamation, and any one of those violations that they could get you on. And we were guilty of violating that proclamation. Because we made it a goddamn good point. We ain't going to live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
It was an absolute defiance. Hmm?
Okay.
It was like the Irish paying tax to the Protestant church. You know?
Uh-huh.
So we weren't going to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't. And they were in there for all sorts of things. And there were quite a few of them there.
Yeah, how many people would you say? Do you have any idea?
Well, he didn't get a head count. I've heard there were 300-400 over there.
Uh-huh,
okay. Hmm?
Well, that must have been very hard on the spouses and children.
Oh, yes, yes. And what? They had visiting hours over there.
Uh-huh.
And they'd go over and visit with them and take them food and...
Clothes
and cigarettes and the like of that. But the women, the wives, but here again, you see, the ladies' auxiliary of the union had tried to embrace the families as much as possible, the wives of the strikers. so they knew what it was all about. It wasn't that they were just cold-blooded things, you see. Now, and another thing, the guys that they got in that stockade, for the most part, in the main, were the better fighters in the Union. And they were closer to the conduct of the strike. And their families, of course, naturally, if a man's a strong Union person and appraised of what's going on, has got his wife down attending the ladies' auxiliary meetings, or if he carries home a good message about the Union and keeps his family informed, the family weren't as bad off as in some of the cases that Mother Jones defended. I guess you're familiar with her.
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
You know, and she made good use of the understanding of the women, and they played a big major role in many of the battles that she was involved in. Many times the strikes might have been defeated if it hadn't been for much worse off than if it wouldn't have been for her. That's my reading of her.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you.
She was an indomitable gal, I'll tell you.
Well, there's been others like her.
Yes.
We haven't gotten the press that she has, but there's been others like her. Sure.
Well, the fight's going on right today in the ERA, where they're trying to clobber everybody that's got anything to say.
That's right.
Hmm?
We'll get there yet, though.
Oh, I know you will.
We'll get there yet.
Yeah. There's power, in the band of working women. Let's change the language a little.
That's right. Well, so I'm also interested, I don't know if you would know the answer to this, but these people were placed in the stockade by virtue of a legal order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that they were convicted of something and they have something on their record to this
effect?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh,
my. In my opinion, they were all set there. First they were apprehended. And then they had a provost marshal, P-R-O-V-O-S-T. And they went through the facade of having a Nuremberg trial there, you know. And they brought this guy in, and he was read off. Of course, I stayed away from those places.
Sure.
You know, it might get you for association. So I stayed away, but the guys tell me what happened. They charge him with this, that, and the other, and the provost marshal found them guilty and sentenced them and give them a fixed term. Now, when it become necessary to vacate the stockade so they can conduct the Minnesota State Fair, the people were transported to the Minneapolis City Workhouse, and they were confined there as civil prisoners. You know that, of course.
Now, with so many people, so many of the stronger, more active people put out of commission by being in the stockade, was the Union able to carry on its picket activities?
Well, you bet we
were. Did more people come out to help in reaction to the fact that people had been put in the stockade?
Oh, I suppose there was some of that, yes. But remember, we had a pretty good membership. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of people in the kindred crafts, you know, that were in the trades, and a lot of people in the ERA, and there were people, families, and I know in my case, my brothers were there. They were young. My brother Don was very young, but he was there. That was his life. And while it's true, and you're correct in your analysis, that the guys that they caught in the main were the good fighters for the Union. Because when you get a bunch of guys together and say, look, fellas, the National Guards are on the street, and we're going to have to stop those trucks. It's going to be a rough go. Someone's going to get hurt. You're talking to a bunch of men that agree to go out and do that are determined, courageous people. They're not Casper Milquetoast. Now, some guys got snared just because they were innocent. And I suppose there might have been innocent people apprehended by the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they got the better fighters. But it's kind of like China, you know. There was enough of us left there to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting then. So that the public was, and the labor community did not all of a sudden become convinced, well, my God, if these people can be arrested and thrown in the stockade, they must not be very good. They didn't have that response.
No, the people felt, I tell you, the thing come off. The thing, I don't like to be harping on it, but the thing come off in such a manner that whoever was dealing the chess game there, we got all the kings, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like Scogie and Ray and Farrell and Bill and a few more, they managed to outmaneuver or outplay the governor in the role there. And they done it by just common logic. And in so doing, and I tell you, our paper, the organizer, was of some service, you know. And that went out, boy, that was out every place. And the people become aware. And here again, I know it's hard for you to understand, but anyone that wasn't through that depression period of 29 to 34, and I'm not trying to talk down to anyone, you just can't realize the degradation, the loss of dignity, that went with it. And finally, people responded. Well, look what happened in Nicaragua. Look what they endured under Somoza for all those years. And suddenly they had enough. Well, that period, and I can't say that Farrell and Ray and Carl and the leaders of the union were responsible for everybody getting salvation. A lot of people had reached the breaking point in their own understanding, and this was the thing that crystallized it. But we did get a lot of good support from people that weren't members of our union, were members of other crafts.
Well, it sounds as though something very unusual happened there. This whole instance of the union headquarters being raided was in itself a negative thing. But in a way, it seems as though the effect of it was almost a good one.
It was very positive. It turned out that way. And of course, here again, if anyone would have been taken in by all that soft shoe maneuvering, you know, it would have been, as you correctly described it, it started out to be negative, but it turned around to be more or less positive. I think that's a good assumption.
Well, that's a very fascinating thing to be observing, the way social interactions have a different result than they're intended to have.
Right.
And the way they can draw people together.
That's right. And after all, basically, human people are human. And you can commiserate with a guy who's being abused, even maybe you don't feel you can do anything about it, but you can still feel bad about it. Our getting out of Vietnam come of that kind of thinking. When I first started to speak out about involvement in Vietnam, why, a lot of my friends were looking at me, you know, that they didn't want to talk to you. But gradually it kept going. And I think in times of crisis like there was in Minneapolis, thoughts are crystallized very quickly. But the dormant reaction had to be there.
Well, what interests me is, what is it exactly, at what point in time did the ideas click for people? Because there could have been many instances previous to this in the strike where different types of, you know, that the populace could have reacted differently and in a more unified fashion.
Well, I can't answer that either, except I can speculate again that, you know, the average person doesn't want to see other people abused. The average person will not try to run over a dog or a cat driving his car. Now, I'm talking about the sadistic macho type, you know. They're not happy unless they're abusing people. But they're not the average. Most of the average people in America and in the world, and I've traveled quite a bit around it, are compassionate people. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't speak up until they're driven to. And some of them don't ever speak up, but by their actions, they support those that are speaking up. And at what point in time, as you say, I don't think there was any magic thing. It's just that, you know, when you're a youngster and you're eating and you eat and you get sick, that's when you quit eating. Well, the people had the same kind of a stomach. They'd just taken so much that this was it. And I suppose each person rebelled at his own rate. Mm-hmm. But rebel they did. We can't disagree with that.
That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, we've just got a couple more minutes on the tape now, so is there anything else you'd like to say about that whole series of events surrounding the raid?
Not that I can think of in the moment. Of course, there's a lot I got to say about it, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, where shall we pick up next time we talk?
Well, your next question, not the next one. Yes, your question was anything accomplished by this meeting? Mm-hmm. Well, we got our headquarters back, our cars, and so forth.
Okay.
And I think it proved another decisive point in Olson's role.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what that was accomplished. Now, I don't know if we got into that question.
I feel as though the answer to that question surfaced as you were speaking.
Yeah, I think so too.
Okay.
Now we come to the next question about internal problems in the union.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just about closing time, that's where we are in the calendar.
Okay.
Now does that square with you?
Yes, it does.
Hmm?
Yes, it does. Shall we start off at that point?
We will. And what time and where?
Okay. It seems to be good to space it at about 2 weeks.
Fine.
That's okay with you, which would mean today, let's see, today is Wednesday the 19th.
God, I swear I was going to put a calendar up. I did, too.
I managed to remember to do that.
I got one here in front of me.
Okay. So 2 weeks from now would be Wednesday, October 3rd.
Okay.
And if 9 a.m. your time is okay, then
fine.
I'll call you.
Is that better for you?
That's fine.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so this has been an enjoyable conversation and very informative as usual.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a call on Wednesday, October 3rd at 9 a.m. your time.
Yeah. Now, I think I made the points that I wanted to make about Bill Sinnott.
Yeah, I'm glad that you did that, and it is on tape, so that will...
Yeah. Now, there are... That book, the Blue Eagle, that he wrote, and there was also another book that was written by the secretary of the San Francisco Employers Association, Paul Elio, E-L-I-E-L. And as I say, there is some reaction here, not a reaction, but some connection with the role that the Minneapolis employers played, and also the role of the San Francisco employers. The same thing was being manifested.
So that they were in consultation with one another?
Well, I'm sure that they had a lot of wires there that were ringing, talking to one another what was going on. These things were happening just about simultaneously.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's right.
And the point that I was making about why the leaders of the union, Carl's explanation to me about the danger of a general strike.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't yet been able to get through to Channel 9 to get the authority for where that film, it's a half-hour documentary on the 1934 strike in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
But I will do that, and I'll put it in the mail for you.
Yes, okay, good.
All right?
Good, okay.
And y'all hear from you on the 3rd of October.
Okay, good.
And good luck to you. It ought to be crabapple time about home there now, shouldn't it?
Oh, boy, you should see the co-ops and the farmer's markets.
The what?
You should see the co-ops and the farmer's markets. There's apples all over.
Yeah? Okay.
See you then. Bye-bye.
You bet.